Welcome to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West, dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
You'll never hear us say that is not a correct statement.
How true it is.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Emil Franzink's Voices of the West. I'm Harry Alexander, Bunker de France across the way. In Los Angeles, a long way from us, is our good friend Todd Roberts. Howdy, sir.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yes, indeedy. And we got us a good show today. Corey Zamora is with us. We'll get to her in just a bit. She's the daughter of Manuel Zamora, who was the gunsmith to the stars. In fact, that's the name of the book that she wrote. And along with that Dr. Tomas Martinez, I believe it is.
Yes, indeedy.
And her dad was... He did the weapons on Wings from, what was that, 28, 29? That was, it's a silent movie, but that was the very first movie that was honored by the Academy.
And with an Oscar.
With an Oscar. And
also directed by William Wellman Sr.
Yeah.
And we had his son, William Wellman Jr., on the show.
Yes, we did.
So we're quite excited to talk about firearms. We always love talking about firearms.
Guns, I mean, you know,
so, but before we get to all of that stuff, we've got some nonsense to go, and that would be.
Hey.
Oh, I'm sorry. That would be Bunker's Bunkhouse.
Yes, indeedy.
Do not hold your nose while you go in there.
Well, you'd wipe your feet off. Anyhow, this is coming to you from Bunker's Bunkhouse. We're bringing you another edition of The Good, the Bad, and the Bovine. Now, just because Corey doesn't know about this endurance that she's going to have to go through, I'm going to explain it. I start with today's date. I go back three days in time, 3 days in forward time travel, but the forward days are still in the past. Now, and we're going to start with...
It's like, like being in the Twilight Zone.
It is the tumbling Twilight Zone. Okay, we're going to start with February 18, 1861. Lincoln County War begins with the murder of John Tunstall, English-born rancher and merchant, killed by deputies Morton, Hill, and Evans. And I'll say no more about that because I'll get riled up being from Lincoln County. Now, on the 19th of February in 1945, nearly 30,000 Marines land on Iwo Jima, resulting in one of the bloodiest battles in the Corps' history. Interestingly, only 216 Japanese prisoners were taken out of a force of approximately 21,000. The rest of them either died or killed themselves.
Wow.
Now, that's woo. Anyhow, February 20th, 1725, 10 sleeping Indians, innocent Indians just sleeping there all by their lonesome, were scalped by whites in New Hampshire for the $100 or 100 pound scalp. That's English pounds were worth more than American dollars, so that was a good thing.
Well, anyhow, they didn't have American dollars yet.
Well, they had colonial dollars then. And the six of those were children. And bounty, just for your information out there, was an English innovation. Hmm. The Indians didn't start it. Hmm. On February 21st, 1946, Alan Rickman was born, mm-hmm. played Elliot Marston in Quigley Down Under in 1990, and he took the part because he'd always wanted to travel to visit Australia.
Okay.
That was his motivation. Another interesting thing was originally that was to be done by Steve McQueen, but he became ill with what finally took him out, so mm-hmm. and a couple other people, but in fact, Tom Selleck was a choice, but he couldn't do it because of commitments. And then about 10 years later, he was free of commitments, and he said, let's do it. And everybody said, you bet. Okay, now, on February 22nd, 1732, George Washington was born. That was a president's birthday.
Yeah.
Not last month. here's a quote from him. Truth will ultimately prevail when there is pains to bring it to life. He's a wise man, and he said wise things. February 23, 1836, Mexican troops under General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna entered San Antonio de Bexar, Texas, or Tejas, and surrounded the Alamo. And we'll finish off this little journey into agony with February 29, 1779. Lieutenant Colonel George Rogers Clark of the Kentucky Militia captures British-controlled Vincennes without firing a shot, followed up by the attack on Fort Sackville. Was pretty bloody.
Okay.
That's it. There'll be tests and questions later.
Yeah, the dog ate my homework.
Oh, okay. That's all right. I'll torment Corey with questions.
All right, let's bring on Corey Zamora. She's in Fresno, California. And
Freezing in Fresno.
Freezing in Fresno. There you go. Corey, Corey, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Your dad was quite the guy, and that's what your book is all about. Manuel Zamora, the gunsmith to the stars. You and Dr. Tomas wrote that.
There's a lot behind what you just said. First of all, I didn't know half of what I found out for the book because no one talked back then. It was their job, and they acted like they were just going to work. It was no big deal. Mm-hmm. Plus, my father didn't talk that much because he was hard of hearing from testing bombs for Howard Hughes, and he had a very thick accent that he was self-conscious of. My mother, well, that's another story. She never knew anything to tell me because she was in her own world. It's part of it, but it's not the important part. It's just I told her in this book she learned things about him she didn't even know, and she even questioned pictures that I had, asking who it was, and I said, "Well, that's my father." She had never seen him without a mustache. Just all kinds of strange things that I think go back to older generations that never talked.
How long were they married?
26 years.
Okay.
I was born, get this, I was born when he was 56 years old.
Okay.
You rascal.
Still.
Oh, I mean, I I had a friend who thinks she's going to have a kid when she's 50, and I said, "Dear, I've been 50. Trust me, you don't want a kid when you're 50."
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I can really, really, really have empathy towards what he was going through, knowing the type of person he was, and then having this kid. But both of my parents were the poster people for people who should never have kids. They did it because you were supposed to. And then after they did it, they were like, "Oh, no.
What did we do? Yep.
Because they were from the Victorian era.
Yep.
And especially my father, who was born in 1897, in a very rich family in Puebla. They owned the textile mills there. I still have friends here that know those mills. Wow. And have family members that still work in the mills. They were very Victorian, and children were not supposed to know anything. Mm-hmm. Yet I've always known so much, and I've always asked questions, and that irritated them to no end. I was like 2 going on 40. But, you know, it was self-preservation for me.
Sure.
Because they were so odd to me. She was 30 when she had me, and he was 56. So uh-huh. It was just very strange. I never learned anything about my culture because when he immigrated here in 1921, the government said, "You forget everything, you don't need it anymore." And of course, now we know being bilingual is awesome.
Did he come to the United States from Mexico or from Spain?
From Puebla, but his family came from Spain. Mm-hmm. Zamora is the only place you're going to find that is in Spain, Zamora, Spain. Mm-hmm. It's up in the high country. And the family came to Mexico from there and went to Puebla. And I never knew anything about Puebla. I never even had mole. I don't even know how to make a... I mean, I'm lucky if I make chamoy and guacamole, because I was being raised as a white person, and
yeah.
I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm brown, I look just like my dad, and my instincts are all right there. Being indigenous, my mother had no concept of any of this. I came out of her, I'm supposed to be like her, but I'm indigenous, and we're very different people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a struggle. It really was. But I learned by watching. I watched everything he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a Gemini and a collector. And if there was more than one of something, it was in a box labeled and put on a shelf alphabetically because it might come in handy later.
So it's like me.
It was like a hoarder with ADHD or, it was something, it was incredible. But I learned from watching him, but he refused to teach me because I was female. And now, I mean, like,
good man.
I should have been an armorer, but it wasn't allowed then. So it was different. But I learned a lot of things from writing the book. My biggest problem was my co-author. I haven't talked to him in years. I don't even know if he's still on the planet. But all he could think of was screenplay.
Mm.
And I'm going, no, I don't want it like this. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't my book. He came to me and asked if he could write the book because he had written a book on Joaquin Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
So he, was really into this. And I didn't speak Spanish because we weren't allowed to. So I needed somebody, and he came, and he didn't ask for any money, anything, just my pictures and my stories, and it put it together. And I'm grateful that the book exists because it needed to be out there. And the gentleman that did the preface in the book now has all the photographs in his archives, Bison archives. So I was glad for all of that. I just wish it had been written differently.
Mm-hmm.
But, it is what it is.
Would you say that your dad was perhaps the first armorer in the fledgling Hollywood? No? Mm-hmm. Bunker shaking his head no.
Yes, I would, because he started with silent films with Howard Hughes. He met Howard Hughes. His port of entry was, El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
I had to sing a song in my head. That was his point of entry, which meant a lot to me because I went to teach in El Paso a couple years ago, and it was really strange being there, looking off, knowing a border was there, and in 1921, he had all his papers, and he came across, and he met Howard Hughes when he had the tool company.
Mm.
And then Howard Hughes started working for the war, and my father was the experimental armorer with experimental weapons and such. And he was introduced to the movies by Howard Hughes as that, so he qualified for what they needed. So he went from silent films to Wings, which became sound in the middle of its production, as I remember.
Right.
And did win the first Best Picture. But he flew planes and shot off guns and built the guns and fixed the guns and did all that. But he never talked about it. I never saw a lot of the pictures, like the cover of the book, where he's with Frank Sinatra and everybody. He never talked about that. To him, it was just like going to the factory.
Yeah.
It was no big deal.
That's the way it was back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Todd,
I guess so.
Todd, jump in there.
So, Corey,
yes.
I have to say that reading the book, it's kind of amazing. The fact that he survives three firing squads in 2 days in Revolutionary Mexico, and then goes to work with Big Jim Colosimo, Johnny Torrio, and Al Capone. I mean,
yes.
How stunned and overwhelmed were you when you found these things out because he didn't talk about them?
Well, actually, he sort of hinted at things. Like when they came over after he had been forced into retirement by MGM because he was 65, that killed him. Some weird people came over, and when they left, he said they wanted him to make silencers, and he said he knew who they were, and he wasn't going to do it. He didn't want to be in Joliet or Sing Sing the rest of his life. So I had hints of things, but not having anybody recording it or doing family stories or oral history, it was hard. It was very hard. When he met Hughes, it was the tool company, and that was after all of that happened with Pancho Villa. I mean, I follow a page on Facebook now. It is all about Pancho Villa, and I see pictures of him, and I also see the United States Native Americans, not Mesoamericans, but Native Americans that lived across the borders there. Mm-hmm. And now I understand my father's fascination with the Old West. He devoured books on the Old West, and he loved when he worked on Westerns. I think he liked the Westerns better than like some of the other ones, Rapid Patrol, things like that he worked on.
Mm-hmm.
because he was in that era. And Ponce de Leon was a good friend of his, but then so was some of the revolutionaries. So that's how he got put in front of a wall three times and pulled over three times by different people, and Pancho Villa was one of them. So it's been great seeing all these pictures and knowing that my father's pictures date back to the same thing.
That is so
cool. And they also verify everything, too.
That is so cool. Bunker, go ahead.
The way it was written, he wrote it as a screenplay, and it pissed me off.
Yeah, I can understand that.
You know, it's not about you, but, you know, when somebody lives their whole life and it's all about them, then he made the book more all about his talent or his supposed talent at screenplay. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't do much except get my few little chapters in there, and I write as I speak. So everybody can always tell what I wrote because that's how I speak. Mm. So it was a hard book to do, and then you got a mother over here going, "Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Where'd you find that?" You know, it was just really bizarre. Not like any other family I've ever been around who all knows everybody else's business.
Yeah, my family was like that. from the old country, and there were certain things that were not talked about, and my brother and I found out much later about some of those things.
Same way with my family.
I was in my later teens when I found out I had a half sister, but that's another story. That's from my mother's side. So anyway, my dad was very quiet, and he had a system to everything. Even how he put his clothes on in the morning, it was all in a specific order. And I can see all that because he was so in another country with a thick accent. I think a lot of things were internalized. I love this story in the book where they were bored and somebody took all the guns apart and threw all the parts in a pile and nobody could assemble them. And my dad had them all assembled in a half hour.
Wow.
That's who he was.
I'll give you a little bit of an explanation there. This is just bunker psychology. But your dad, by the way you describe him, that's the way an armorer would have to be. You know, everything, you know, you don't put a gun together, just grab a piece here, grab. Each one is a step in the progress. And and when you're dealing with guns or explosives, you don't take shortcuts. You don't, you know, cheat. You do it exactly right, and at the end of the day, you still have all your fingers and toes
and your life.
Yeah, and your life.
Yeah,
but you know, one of the things that fascinated me about your dad and the book itself is that getting behind the scenes stuff of Hollywood, especially in the golden age. So much of it comes out of the publicity departments that most of it is BS. And when you can get something, you know, from the person who was there, who did it, and you've got photos to verify it and back it up, you've got something there that's to me is primary and belongs in any library about movies.
Sure, yeah, and, no question.
And you know, one of the things too about your dad is that he was an expert in movie art, but he made firearms. He created functional firearms out of firearms.
Yes, because they had to reproduce an antique-looking gun for a period movie. He could get on that metal lathe and make it look like something from the 1500s. You know, you could just do it.
No.
So yes, he was all around what he did. He knew every aspect of it. And that's what he always wanted to do, is that and fly planes. And, of course, his family put him in medical school, but he got himself out of that. So,
another shame, yeah.
All right. We need to take our first commercial break here before we're flying around.
And, all right.
Yeah. Corey Zamora is our guest here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, and Todd Roberts with you. We're talking about her dad, Manuel Zamora, and we'll be right back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club is one of the best-kept economic secrets in town. This 900-member group maintains one of the finest shotgun shooting ranges in the country, featuring trap, skeet, five-stand, and sporting clays fields, and hosts national and international events that bring thousands of people and millions of dollars into our community. The Spring Satellite Grand American Tournament alone involves 1,200 participants for 10 days. Learn more about this and their other contributions to our community at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com.
I got a wire telespatch for you. Look, for you. Good news. It's good news.
Good news?
Yeah.
Pancho, if this telegram is for me, how do you know what's in it?
Well, I know what's in it because I look at it through the corner of one eye. It's like we see.
Pancho.
This is the Voices of the West.
I made up my mind to change my way and quit the crowd that was so gay, and I leave my home for a little while and travel west for many a mile.
We are back on AMO Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts with you, and our guest is Corey Zamora. I was thinking Cindy because I have a thing here I need to talk about.
Talk about it.
I do. This came from our friend of the show and friend, Cindy Mitchum, and she says the first reprint edition of Dad's book, Them Ornery Mitchum Boys, will be available in March. You can do a pre-sale order at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Walmart right now. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can get one at johnmitchum.com. And also, they're having a fun book signing event on May 9th at the Buggy Barn in Blanco, Texas. Mitchum screenings, Q&A with Joe Cornette, hosting people who worked with Dad and Uncle Bob. Live music, quick gun artist, a John Wayne impersonator, and so much more. And Cindy closes it out by saying, the world could use a little Mitchum right now.
Well, you're darn right, Pilgrim.
All right, back to Corey. Now, he would take a firearm and turn it into an antique. Is that what you're saying?
He should do conversions.
Actually, if there were pictures of them, he would actually make it on a metal lathe.
Okay.
Parts, make it a whole thing, mm-hmm. because it was obsolete. So they would show pictures of what was correct for that period, and he would make the gun. That's sort of how he got involved with Man from U.N.C.L.E. They made a bunch of guns to look like they wanted him to look, but they didn't work. And so somebody, Stembridge said, oh, there's this man over at MGM, and I bet he can take care of it. So they took my dad all the guns, and he made them work.
Wow.
Well, you know.
And that was a cool gun that Solo carried.
Well, you know, we know he was a skilled gunsmith, an explosive expert. But as I understand, he was also a top pilot and an ace mechanic. And from my sources, it says that he flew in Wings, Hell's Angels, and King Kong. And I can just see him up there pumping lead into that big monkey.
Actually, in King Kong, he was supposed to fly the plane. But the guy who was supposed to do the gun didn't know how to use it. So at the last minute, my father is the one that actually shoots him off the Empire State Building. It still makes me cry. As a little kid, oh no, my daddy killed him. It killed me.
Did he take him home and stuff him and put him in the den?
No, it was it was made in pieces. There was a huge hand, and they would do stop motion. And you could, if you look, and if you know what to look for, you can see indentations in the fur of where the men had moved the head and the arms and such around. So there was a puppet, then there was a big head, and then there were hands. Yeah. So there were different parts up close, and then the whole eight put together.
Yeah, it was Ray Harryhausen.
And I really had to listen hard to get any of these things from anybody. he didn't talk too much, but he had people he certainly didn't care for.
those folks he'll talk a lot about.
Well, I worked for 30 years as a stuntman, and when I started in those days, stuntmen never told anybody who they doubled and what they did. They just said, I fall off horses. And you could cost you a job if you said, I double so-and-so. It could cost you a job and maybe many of them.
Todd Roberts, get in there, Betty.
So, Corey, this life that he led, it's just fascinating to me that he didn't really talk about it, and he didn't really talk all of it to your mom. And, so when you were with him, he was a different person. He was your dad. So what did you guys do together? How did you spend your time?
Not very much at all, because he was so much older. And his perception of where children's place is was totally Victorian. We sort of had some really, good times, but it wasn't like a regulation family. I don't know how to put it. It was just very stilted. Everybody had a place. You knew your place and this and that. How they met was odd. They both lived up on Whitley Heights, famous Whitley Heights.
Oh.
And I remember the stories of seeing, she would say Valentino would come down the heights with, he had a limousine and he had a spotlight in the back that shone on him. And nowadays everybody wants to black out their limousine so nobody can see them. So it kind of cracked me up.
Yeah.
So, my mother lived in a Moorish mansion owned by Ruth Robinson, I think. It was her first husband's aunt, and she had collected stuff during the Depression. My father lived across the street with his first wife, Hazel Zamora. And that's an odd story, too, because I used to sing classical music, and I was at a thing one time, and this lady walked up to me, and she says, "You have a very unusual last name. The only time I've ever heard it was Hazel Zamora." And I said, "Well, that was my father's first wife." And the lady about fell over. But, Hazel was in these women's bands that they had during the war. She was a concert pianist, but she made money by doing these all-women jazz bands and such that they did during the war because the men were out fighting.
Yep.
So, but she sort of, my father said that he was just arm candy to her, and she treated him badly. But she did allow him to put a shooting range in the basement so he could stay in practice. It's funny because we'd go to the Santa Monica Pier, and we'd go to the little shooting ranges, and he'd win me stuff. And then they got wise. We'd come down the pier, and they go, "Oh, no, you can't come here," because they knew he was an expert. And he was going to get everything.
Yeah.
So, it was subtle the way you knew about him. You watched him do things. You went, he was ambidextrous. I'm ambidextrous. The whole thing, how he was, you had to really watch and pay attention to learn, because he really wasn't going to say that much. And then when I started going through things, like I found that newspaper clipping about the firing squads, nobody ever told me that. I found it, just found it.
Wow.
And then, of course, then nobody wants to talk about it. So
that's hard. Interesting. Yeah.
It was hard. But I learned a lot of things that made me, like the story I told about seeing Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. The mothers would put a bunch of kids in the car and take them to a theater. And there's one, they had a German maid. And at one scene, I think it was Frederick Murray, tells her to go get some sun on the beach. And the next scene, she's all packed up and going out the door. And somebody asks, I think it was Maureen O'Hara, I don't know, asked him what happened. And he said, I don't know. I just told her to go get some sun on the beach. And my father's thing all day was son of a bitch this and son of a bitch that. I'm the only kid in the theater laughing my ass off, okay? Because I get it. I get it. It's funnier than hell to me.
Yeah, right.
But nobody else had a parent that's his son of a bitch all the time. So.
That is
anything
classic.
He was mad at was his son of a bitch.
That's,
you know?
Classic. In his accent, too, right?
Yes.
Son of a bitch.
He would whistle and sing Feliz Lindo and some other little songs when he thought he was alone. But my bedroom windows were on the driveway. So he would come up and down the driveway and he'd whistle or sing something. I knew what was going on, but he would never do any of that in front of my mother, per se. She, I don't know, she just wasn't into that. She just figured, well, you came here, you stepped across a line, and all of a sudden you're white. Just like she thought, you came out of me, so you're white. And she was just a very odd person. So I think he kept some things from her because that wasn't to her liking. In fact, I didn't get to do a lot of things for my culture from him until my mother passed away.
Wow.
And then I read about Puebla, and I was gifted a China Poblano skirt. And now every day, every year at Day of the Dead and Cinco de Mayo, I go to certain places as the China, and I'm very honored.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Apologies, if listeners, if you're hearing some sort of like whooshing noise, somebody is filling a bathtub somewhere.
And, you know, it's good because cleanliness is next to God.
Well, that's what they say.
Yes, yeah. Oh, you know, I want to go back a little bit to the wartime, and your dad helped develop a very essential machine gun technology, which was the web belt, that canvas belt, because up until that time they were having problems with the belts breaking and jamming. And can you tell us anything more about that?
Well, and they were using magazines, too, especially in the Gatling guns.
This wasn't the Gatling, and this was like the 50 cals.
I got you. Okay.
On the airplane.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a picture of it on the cover of the book. And I didn't know anything about that until I saw the picture one day. So he developed that for Hughes. He even worked on the Spruce Goose.
Wow.
Because of all woodworking and such, because my father was a really good woodworker as well. So there's lots of things that he did that I didn't know until later, which is kind of sad. I really do think it's sad.
Yeah.
But yes, he did the flexible belt for that gun. And I've heard lots of people say that it was, it was so helpful and it was so wonderful and that came about. But that's what he did for Hughes with the experimental armorer.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take our next commercial break here on Amo Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts with you. Our guest is Corey Zamora. The book is Manuel Zamora, Gunsmith to the Stars. Be back.
Can you even imagine switching back to pen and paper to run your business? Every year, we become more and more dependent upon our technology. If your network is not set up properly, you're just one click or one email away from losing data critical to your operation. Arizona Computer Guru offers a host of services to prevent and protect you from disaster. From online backup services to email filtering to fully managed network services, Arizona Computer Guru is here to keep your network secure, your data safe, and your budget in the black. To schedule your free consultation, call 304-8300.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away, it'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club dates from 1948 and is now at 7800 West Ole Ajo Highway. The club owns 80 acres and leases 300 more from Pima County that supports 50 trap fields, 15 skeet fields, 2 5-stand fields, 2 sporting plays courses with 12 stations each, a 9,000 square foot clubhouse, 200 full service RV hookups for members, and free Wi-Fi. This expansive facility gives enough room to host major national and international events annually, bringing thousands of people to the community. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSki.com.
Keep your hands on the desk, Gorman.
I thought I told you to stay out of town.
Listen, you three, I don't mind being ambushed. Sometimes I think it's fun, but I don't think it's fun when there's a lady along.
This is the Voices of the West.
Back on AML Franzi's Voices of the West, Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts in Los Angeles, and out of Fresno, California, it is Cori Zamora. And the topic is the book that she co-authored, and it's called Manuel Zamora, Gunsmith to the Stars, and that happens to be her dad.
We were just talking about the flexible belt for the Browning.
Yeah.
I don't know that those pictures went to Mark Wanamaker's Bison archives because that was war and not movies. But mm-hmm. all the rest of the pictures that I found from all the various gun rooms, Paramount, MGM, he worked a little bit for Lucy. She used to get him to go into the sound stages and kill birds if they were up there and they couldn't get the bird out of the sound stage. She called him Manny. Go get Manny! Go get Manny! I got a bird in here. So, yeah. And that's when the Paramount was right up next to Hollywood Forever Cemetery. And then Lucy and Desi had some stuff there before they built all the stuff in Culver City. And we moved to Culver City so my dad could walk to MGM. He walked everywhere. He walked a lot. When he passed away, he was still the same size as he was forever. So, and he passed away, I think that this is interesting, with what 92 other people passed away from, making a movie for Howard Hughes. And I was totally floored when I read about this because it's actually number one on the list of the 50th worst movies ever made.
Oh,
and,
yes.
It was called The Conqueror.
Yes.
You can believe it. John Wayne was Genghis Khan. I won't even do my
Pedro Armendariz.
Oh, my God.
Mike Wazurki.
Mike Wazurki.
6'4" guys playing 5'2" people.
Yes.
Hayward.
Yep.
Well,
that, and her dress from that movie is in the museum in Hollywood in Highland, and talks about how everybody died. There's a picture that they thought was funny of Clark Gable doing a Geiger counter, and they're showing the reading on it. But what happened was they picked this place in Utah to shoot this movie, and then a bomb was tested, and it was called the Dirty Harry. The wind shifted, and it all went to where they were.
Oh, my.
You know, and of course, those days, they didn't be thinking of it. They take the kids out of school, put them on a bench, look at the pretty cloud, you know.
Yeah.
Crazy. Just nuts. So my father didn't work in Utah. This is how it gets even odder. He worked on the sound stages doing the rest of the scenes, and there had to be continuity. So they took 70 tons of dirt from Utah to Culver City. And to this day, there is still a cancer cluster in a condo development that came up around.
Oh, that's awful.
It was Tarzan's Lake. We used to go on that back lot, the third lot, and play around Tarzan's Lake. And that became a condo place, but also there's a cancer cluster there. So they don't know what happened to all the dirt. To this day, they don't even know what happened to any of it. It was spread out for different scenes, for continuity on different sound stages throughout Culver City and maybe even other studios. We don't know.
Don't even ask the mayor. she won't know.
Well, speaking of politics, and this is not politics, actually, but this is something, I don't know if it's a quote or a description of your dad, and it said that he, coming from the sources, says, believe, He believed people should support the country they live in. And I thought that is such a unique way of looking at it. You know, just looking at
Yes, yes. Sure. But he was totally the brown accented American, you know? And it's kind of hard on me now because I have people come up to me and just start speaking Spanish because they assume I'm going to speak Spanish. And I almost cry when I tell them I can't. And I wasn't even supported to learn it in high school or in school. There was no support at home at all. And when I got all of his naturalization papers, finally, from my mother, they had the seal of Mexico in them. She called them mementos. I just wanted to slap her.
Wow.
You know, she just never really got it because it didn't have anything to do with her. So she just said, oh, Latin men, really status to have a Latin man. So to this day, all I can see is, they married each other's arm candy. I don't know. It's just really strange.
And that's so
pretty
Corey,
separate lives.
Like
yeah.
Ricardo Montalban.
So, Corey, I have to ask you, what do you think, what did you, through your research or maybe your dad told you, what was his biggest challenge in gunsmithing? What was the one thing that really perplexed him?
Working with people he didn't quite care for or that, turned out to be kind of racist, and he had, you know, incidents with these people, and then he didn't care for Louis B. Mayer, but he told me this great story. We went to meet some people at this old hotel downtown. I think it's called the Alexandria, and that
yes.
was the elevator where Louis B. Mayer got in a fight with Valentino. I think that's how it goes. I'm not sure, but anyway, they got in a fist fight. And my dad was acting it out in front of this elevator in this hotel. It was fascinating. He was all worked up talking about it. So, and then cool. He had an incident. He had to work with John Wayne, who either you know or you don't know, but he was very racist. And John Wayne liked to get in the truck with my dad at Paramount and ride out to the Agoura, where they shot all the Westerns in the valley. And one day, he said, Manuel, I think actually they called him Manny, and he hated that. What's in this truck? And he told him it was all explosives. And John Wayne got out of that truck so fast, he never rode with him again. So my dad just thought he was kind of, you know, a sissy, so to speak, and just kind of, yeah, that was my great John Wayne story that he told me. He actually told me that, so that's why it really sticks in my head, because he didn't tell me much.
Yeah, did your dad learn go to school or learn? How did he learn about explosives? Because that's not something.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Probably from Pancho Villa.
Well, yeah, that could be. Yeah.
Yeah, because he also knew pyrotechnics. I was a month late being born. So on the 4th of July, my mother was up at the top in L.A., of the Coliseum, where he was shooting the fireworks off that tower.
So,
if you know anything about the L.A. Coliseum, it's got a tower on the one end. And so he did fireworks and special effects. Mm-hmm. He worked on Ben-Hur. In fact, I think he worked on every version of Ben-Hur ever made.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he brought me back these little Roman soldiers that swam in my bathtub that were during this sea fight. And they had these huge tanks at MGM where all the men were in waders, and they had these big ships, and the thing was full of water, and there was a background painted. In fact, where we lived, when you went down to Culver Boulevard and looked down to Olinda, you could still see some of the backgrounds that they switched around for these tanks.
Wow.
If you went up to the fence at Olinda, you could see a street coming down from China next to something in New York. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to grow up there. And then on studio day, the studio club, we were all allowed to go onto the lot and we could play and look at everything. It was fascinating. Nothing was off limits.
Well, Corey, we've been talking a lot about your dad, and you yourself, you're a dancer. You've had a very long and very successful career. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your dancing.
Well, they never, because I was brown, they didn't really know what to do with me. They didn't think I'd be educated or worth educating. But when they would play music, I would dance. So when I was 3 years old, I was taken to a studio in Culver City owned by Ruth Kettle. And Ruth Kettle said, I don't take them until they're five. And my mother said, put something on and just watch her. Ruth Kettle took me. And that just came up in Facebook the other day. Somebody posted the Aragon Ballroom. My first recital when I was 3 years old was on the stage where Lawrence Welk used to broadcast from the Aragon Ballroom. I would dance on the stage at the Aragon. It just blew my mind when I remembered that. Yeah. But I started classical ballet. I did formal training in ballet, tap, a little bit of flamenco, which I didn't like. It's too formal, and that's the only form of dance that has never changed. And then I got into, they found that I could sing. I had a 4.5-octave range. Then I ended up singing opera for 11 years. All of that came to a culmination when my body wasn't a ballerina's body. So when I was 21, I was taken to this very famous place on Vermont in Hollywood called the Fez. All the movie stars went there. Everybody went there. It was owned by Mr. Chalabi, and I'm friends with his daughter, Roxanne Chalabi. They're Lebanese. And that's where I saw my very first belly dancer. And the three dancers I saw became my teachers. Two of them are still with us today. One passed away recently. I am a master in a certain style of Middle Eastern dance that only came about in America. And briefly, it's called American Cabaret because it happened in America. And this is in the clubs. The bands didn't know each other's music. So you have an Armenian sitting next to a Turkish guy, next to an Egyptian guy, next to a Lebanese.
Okay.
They don't know the music, each other's music. And so what I do, I have certain steps to go with certain rhythms, tempos, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, 8. But the order that they are put in is up to me. So this is was my liberation from ballet, where some the choreography was telling me to do something, and I just wasn't hearing it. I wasn't hearing any of it. So this
you were,
is a
you were doing free form.
yeah, and that's what American Cabaret is free form, because you can't choreograph if you don't know what they're going to play. Yeah. And most of the time, we did not know what they were going to play.
Wow.
We knew where they were going to open with a 2-4 and go to an 8-count Schizzatelli, then go into a 4-4 melody, and then there'd be a drum solo, a Schizzatelli floor, and maybe a 9-8 if the Turkish guy was in the band. But you didn't know. So that's why I feel like what I'm a master in and what I coach in, this is like the most vast form of Middle Eastern dance. We use moves and music from 13 different countries of the Middle East and North Africa.
And
what they call East Europe, meaning Turkey, Armenia.
Uh-huh. Now, I asked this because I wanted to ask this question more than anything else from the beginning of the show. How do you keep the ruby in the belly button?
I've never had a ruby in my belly button.
Oh.
That's totally made up in the movies. Yes. It's totally made up. A lot of it was just fantasy, because when they started putting that stuff in the movies, all they had was their imagination and what they thought it might be. I think when in Chicago, when they had the World's Fair and they brought that troupe over from Turkey, people saw it for real for the first time, and which is interesting because I believe a lot of things that we later saw in vaudeville came from that Turkish troupe that
these
was
trippers
at the Chicago World's Fair that year.
Mm-hmm.
No, the hook.
Oh, the hoofers, huh?
The hook.
We didn't know.
No, hook on
when
the stage.
When you hook somebody on the stage, hook you off the stage.
That's a great idea.
We dance, yes, Middle Eastern people, especially Egypt and Lebanese, we dance with a cane. The cane is a sign of that you're the one in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And I if they did a cane dance, they got that. They also, the magician's assistants, the thing where they ripple their fingers, that's a Turkish hand shimmy. It's not jazz hands, which irritates the crap out of me. You know, there's just all kinds of things that came about. And so I'm a historian.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I do is authentic. I have not fused things, other things, that, like I don't put modern jazz in it or Afro-Cuban in it. So people come to me, and I have a great Zoom set up, and all over the world I coach people and help them understand. And I have worked with dancers who have been dancing for 20 years and never played zills.
Hmm.
So and I'm a master percussionist on zills, the hand cymbals.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of things going on that I do, and I'm really proud of it. I think my father's, wherever he is proud of it, too. Every once in a while when I make something or do something, I look around and go, so how am I doing?
Well, and as well, cool. You should be proud.
That's so cool.
We've got to do our final commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. as I lose my voice.
Very interesting.
I'll help you look for it.
Yeah, go look for my voice, please. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you, and our guest is Corey Zamora. The book is Manuel Zamora, Gunsmith to the Stars. We'll be right back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a five-bedroom, three-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
No doubt you've heard about rescue groups for dogs and cats, but did you know there's a rescue group for horses? That's right, it's called Horse It Around Rescue. Founders Steve Boyce and Teresa Worrell are helping out all those equine victims of neglect and cruelty by giving them a place to restore their health and wellness. And Horse It Around provides a nurturing and natural environment where horses can be horses, so they can be adopted out into forever homes. More than 120 horses, mules, and donkeys have been adopted out, but like everything else, it costs money to run the project. Horse It Around is a 501c3 nonprofit located in Southeast Arizona. Your tax-deductible donations to Horse It Around will go a long way so those horses can be horses. Check out the website, horseitaroundrescue.org. Make a difference in a horse's life. That's horseitaroundrescue.org.
Besides bringing millions a year into this community with national and international events, the Tucson Trap and Skeet Club at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway services the local shooting sports community with a 380-acre site featuring trap, skeet, five stand, and two sporting clays fields, as well as a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, which all is available to local shooters, and soon, an archery range. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com or take a drive out west of town and see it for yourself. New members or single-day use, welcome.
Put up the hand. It is Manuel Alonso Valdez who orders it. Comprende?
How is it?
You have meet with the greatest caballero in all the West.
Oh, well, that's different. Are you sure this is the West? Cracky, I thought I was lost.
This is the Voices of the West.
There's a rolling prairie and an old corral at the end of the canyon trail. There's a ranch boss waiting with a howdy pal at the end of the canyon trail.
We're back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts in Los Angeles, our guest Corey Zamora,
howdy,
and howdy pal, and we're talking about her book, Manuel Zamora, Gunsmith to the Stars. Corey, did your dad ever patent any of the things he came up with?
If anything was patented, it was under Howard Hughes' name. He didn't get any credit for anything.
That's typical.
But I have some things. There was a gentleman, he went by Wishbone. He was a cook. Oh, I can't remember the TV show.
Rawhide.
Dragon Train? Rawhide, okay. He gave out some Christmas gifts one year, and I have it. It's a bar tool that looks like a medieval hatchet. When you take it apart, It's all these different things for mixing drinks. And I still have that. I have a lot of things. My father was on top of a bookshelf of shells from like one that's a foot tall down to a tiny bullet. I still have that. I have a lot of things. He wouldn't buy something if he knew how to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Short story, when I was a little bitty kid, he made a squeegee with two boards and a piece of rubber and a handle. And I, you know, of course, what do I know? I'm just a little kid. And I just said, oh, wow, he invented the squeegee. But it's because he refused to buy one because he knew how to make it.
That's great.
You know, Todd wants one of those bar hammer hatchets.
Yeah, things. For sure. We all need one.
Oh, absolutely. What, are you kidding? I'm going to walk around all the bars in Los Angeles with it.
Yeah, right. And then they're going to throw you out of the bars, too.
Terry Nation.
Yeah.
Actually,
well,
I
it won't be the first time, Terry.
I still have it in my, I have it in my bar. I have a, what they call a prohibition bar. It's carved rosewood and the handles are hidden in the carvings.
Nice.
It just looks like a cabinet, but then it opens up and all these glasses and bottles and stuff
Ooh.
Are in it. And I have it in there. It's place of honor.
Nice.
But yeah, Wishbone gave that to him.
That's great.
Paul Brenniger.
Yeah.
Most excellent.
I'm trying to think of other things. Oh, my father collected stamps. So you can understand how awesome it was for him to go through the trash cans of all
sure.
the fan mail from
oh,
all over
God.
The world and
yeah.
he'd be bringing home these stamps.
Oh, wow.
He was disappointed I didn't get into it, but I'm not a stamp person. My indigenous talents take me outside, but his did too. We had an apricot tree that he grafted four different types of peaches on. So
wow.
we had four different types of peaches coming off this apricot tree. So
I bet it was confused.
Yeah.
but I watched him graft. I watched
cool.
him do everything. I watched. That's the only way I could learn because no
yeah.
one was going to tell me anything.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Corey. Now for the very important question that we ask all of our guests about this time in the podcast, in the waning moments of the program. Favorite Western movie or television show?
Oh, wow. Wow.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think. There were so many movies, and there was one that had a lot of miniatures, and I can't remember the name of it, but it had something to do with finding this lost stuff, and there was water that came down. I don't remember. We went to every movie he made and went mm-hmm. to the theater to see it that he worked on. If I had known I'd been asked that question, I would remember.
See, that's why we ask it and
right.
wait till the end.
And oh. The only thing I ever really saw on television, and this is kind of funny, was that show that had Miss Kitty.
Oh, Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke.
Okay. I remember that. And Maverick. He worked
yep.
on Maverick, so we had to watch Maverick all the time. But I always knew what Miss Kitty really was, and nobody else seemed to know. So that was kind of funny to me. But, you know, I was raised with Sun on the Beach. So
yeah, nobody knew that Miss Kitty was really a Sunday school teacher.
Yeah, right, right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what she did.
Yeah, in the cribs upstairs, yes. That's why I've always wanted to go to Tucson.
Uh-huh.
I really would like to go to the,
Tucson?
That has, yes. The ghost town. It has the active
down in Tombstone.
Saloon.
Tombstone, they do.
Yeah, the Birdcage Saloon.
Birdcage Theater. Yeah, that's haunted, and there are a couple of other places down there that are.
I
haunted.
Have a big pull towards that, and for some reason, whenever I go someplace, I'm pulled towards very, very old buildings. So I have this thing about
the whole town is old.
Yeah,
that's great. That's awesome.
Nothing wrong with
I've
that.
I've only been to Phoenix. I've been all the way up to Grand Canyon, which and then Montezuma's Castle, which is like sacred to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been south,
mm-hmm.
so that's going to be something to look into doing for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the erosion up there.
But you made me remember a lot of
Canyon's
westerns
terrible.
That I watched.
Yeah.
You made me remember. I think I liked Maverick because it wasn't so gritty. It had a lot of humor in it.
Sure.
It was more about him, the actor, and his
yeah.
personality
yeah.
than it was blood and guts.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
It helped put Warner Brothers on the map.
Yeah, it sure did. Corey Zamora.
Well, the book has a Facebook page. Anyone has any questions, just look it up.
All right.
I also have a personal Facebook page under Corey Zamora, and I'll answer anything you want to know.
Very well, Corey. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Corey.
Yeah, it was big-time pleasure. Coming up,
thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you. Next time we get together on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West, well, we're not actually going to be together.
We're not going to be dark.
We're going to do a best of program because...
What's any of our shows?
Well, it could be any of our shows, but we'll do a movie Saturday program, best of, and the reason for that. My wife and I are celebrating 54 years of marriage.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That's next week. I tried to convince her we should marry on the 29th. It was a leap year then, but she said no. So, on that note...
78, 79... Adios, all you armorers out there. Keep them machine guns firing.
Thanks a lot for listening, folks.
Thanks for listening to Emil Franzi's Voices of the West.